Welcome to Afterwards, which is Manhattan Theater Club's discussion series at the Biltmore Theater. I'm Lisa McNulty. I'm the Associate Director of Artistic Operations here at MTC, and I'm incredibly fortunate to have three terrific guests with me this afternoon. First, I have Ellen Diamond, who is a professor of English at Rutgers University and co-editor of the upcoming Cambridge Companion to Carol Churchill. Now, there is no way I could do full justice to all of Ellen's accomplishments here, or we wouldn't have time to talk about the play, so I would suggest that you take a peek at the insert in your program, where you can read a full bio of all of her incredible accomplishments. And for these other two chairs, the wonderful Elizabeth Marvel, who played Marlene, and Anna Reeder, who played both Delgret and Nell, will be joining as soon as they can struggle out of wigs and costumes and things. So to get started, Ellen, you've returned often to Churchill's work in your writing and your scholarship. I guess I'd just love to start talking about her as a writer whose plays, you said, and let me quote, create a stunning record of historical reflection and theatrical exuberance. And I would say that those statements are certainly true of Trap Girls. So I'd love to talk about the way that history and theater connect in this play, particularly as it connects to, say, Thatcherist London in the 80s.
Right. Good afternoon.
Oh, can we hear you?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, there we go.
It's a pleasure to be here and to witness this amazing production of this difficult, challenging, but I think absolutely gorgeous play. It's good to sort of put this in context. The play was first produced in 1982. Margaret Thatcher came to power in 78-79. But 82 was the Falklands War.
Right.
And that was this moment of ultra-patriotism. Churchill was part of a totally exuberant, amazing movement of playwrights that sort of got going in the early 70s and into the middle 70s. They were totally left-wing identified. But unlike our situation, left-wing identification was a kind of group badge of honor. And they had support. The Greater London Council supported playwrights. They supported new groups who were banding together as producing companies. So the artists had money, the actors had money, they were left-wing, and they had Margaret Thatcher in power. I mean, that's a pretty incendiary and marvelous situation, right? You've got political contestation, but you have artists who have support. This is astonishing. It's never really happened in this country. I mean, as you know, people in Europe, European countries, and especially the British at this time were really exemplary in doing that. So Churchill was part of a group, David Hare, who still is writing plays, John McGrath, Howard Brenton, mm-hmm. Byron E. Lavery, Nell Dunn, tons of Pam Gems. But Churchill stood out. Her left-wing politics were not unusual. Her feminist politics were not unusual. Her relationship with women's acting groups was not unusual at all. What was unusual was how she wrote.
Mm-hmm.
What was happening, and this she does share with the rest of the playwrights, is that there was really a resistance to realism.
Hi. Okay. And now we're being joined by Elizabeth Marvel,
right,
who just played Marlene.
Thanks.
Hey, it's great to meet you. It's a wonderful production.
And we were just talking about...
Right, I was going on and on about Carol Churchill in the 80s. And I'm just going to come to my point really quickly because now we have a wonderful artist on stage. The point is that they stopped doing plays that looked like realism. They stopped doing plays with beginning, middles, and ends that had a sort of beautiful build and then a powerful climax. They started messing with that realist form. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason why they did is because precisely they wanted to get politics and history in there.
Uh-huh.
So they shortened the scenic structure, they reversed the time a little bit. It's Churchill who took that to the nth degree, right? Cloud Nine came out.
Hi. And here is Anna Reeder, played Delgret and Nell. Well, the thing that I think is exciting about this play is the way that it melds the sort of real and the theatrical.
Exactly.
And Marlene feels like the glue, because of course you track through both the sort of very theatrical first act and the more realistic second act. What is it like to sort of track a character through those very different sort of stylistic, surf the different stylistic choices of a writer through a play, or do you feel like that sort of, you play the role and the role is the role?
That's an interesting question. You know, it's so hard to be objective about what happens in a performance because right. you just sort of go with that moment that's happening sure. and unfolding. But of course, in rehearsal, it's much more of an intellectual exercise. And in rehearsal, it was a very different experience rehearsing the first act versus sure. the third act, mm-hmm. and certainly versus the second act. Each act is sort of a play within itself.
Right.
And that's even how it kind of feels in performance, uh-huh. really.
Do you feel like as a performer, you sort of separate each of them out?
Yes.
That the challenges of each are
unique, uh-huh. yes.
Was the sort of echoing of one person's, of relationships from the beginning and the relationships at the end, a kind of connection? For example, you know, Isabella talks about her sister. Mm-hmm. You registered that really powerfully. The loneliness that's expressed in this sort of cacophonous dialogue in the first act comes mm-hmm. back in spades in the second act. Mm-hmm. I mean, did you discuss this with the director?
No. Actually, much of what happened and continues to happen has unfolded unconsciously. we didn't really score through that specifically. And it's just been by constant listening. And I usually read the play every day before I perform it. And so I just keep sort of mining mm-hmm. what's there. And I hear, if I keep my ears open and I'm doing my job, then I hear new things mm-hmm. every show.
And Anna, I'm curious actually, because of course in the first scene, you're playing somebody who is not only historical, but actually fictional. You're playing Bruegel's Mad Margaret, Dahlgret. What was it like? I mean, was there a particular kind of research that you did? What is it like to sort of enter into somebody who exists, but is fictional? That's separate, I guess, from the work you usually do on a character?
Well, Dahlgret is a Flemish fable of sort of unspecified origins. Mm-hmm. And then Bruegel did basically a portrait of her and a portrait of hell at that time. So it was kind of interesting to conceive of that description of that landscape from within it. Mm-hmm. And I just tried to think of Dahlgret as her own entity, even as if Bruegel were a photographer,
right.
just catching her in that moment. And but you know, obviously looking at the portrait, I think though ultimately it's enough to know that she's a woman in wartime,
right?
And having lost her children, it's enough to propel anyone to the mouth of hell.
Brecht used her for Mother Courage.
Mm-hmm.
It's exactly the same legend.
Mm-hmm.
And that's interesting, too. You know, Churchill would have known Brecht, and they do something totally different. Mm-hmm. I think she honors the courage, and as we know, what Brecht does with Mother Courage is seem to honor her, but of course see her as the hyena of war.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
A male perspective.
Totally, exactly.
I'm curious in that first scene, I mean, the hallmark of that scene is the overlapping dialogue and how you guys might have, what that rehearsal process was, the sort of orchestration, or perhaps lack of orchestration, how you guys sort of wended your way through that dialogue.
And listened your way through that dialogue.
Yeah.
Dahlgret does a lot of listening.
Well, I think that's exactly it. I mean, it was just a gigantic process of listening. I can only speak to it to the extent that I can, which is that a lot of listening and just trying to make oneself understood and also illuminate what the other people are trying to bring across as well.
Mm-hmm.
I had an interesting experience. I came in with that scene memorized because I have a toddler. And so I knew that when I started working, I'd have no time after work to work on lines
right.
or do any of the work I usually due after rehearsal before I had my child. So now the way I work is totally different. And so I did it extremely technically for a long time, and it was very much a piece of music, very, very technical exercise for me for a long time, and I think for most of us. And it wasn't really until we got in here, and even part of the way in here, until everyone really started to breathe life into it and right. and find the joy and the celebration of it, that it shifted into what it is now.
I mean, did James McDonald, the director, who's I think one of the best directors working in London now and here, obviously, did he sort of do listening cues, or did he listen to how things came together and then run you again and say, I need to hear this line, I need to hear that line?
Yes, he did some of that. He did some of that, but he's a very hands-off director.
He is.
He is. Yes. He really is someone that collects a group of people and then lets them do what they do.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when you were having the conversations where the lines overlapped, were you as actresses, were you finishing a moment even though the dialogue action went over there?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Oh, yeah,
because
you have to play
through. This time I really watched Gret and Nijo, and there's a kind of steady...
Well, which side of the house were you sitting on?
Well, it's true, I was sitting over there. I was sitting over there. But I just began to sort of try to work against where the focus was, just to see.
Yeah.
And it seemed like everything got completed. And what, I mean, this is completely eccentric way of actors interacting. So did it...
But it's life, though, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, this is what we do.
Right.
We talk over each other's lines.
Yeah.
As we just know.
All the time. And
that's
we,
perfect.
You know, that was kind of polite of me, but normally I wouldn't back off right. If I have a point, and especially if I'm telling a story.
Well, and all of these women, you know, are people who are used to struggling to be heard, do you know?
Absolutely.
In that room, those people, those very singular women would be used to having to fight to have their voices heard.
As I think most women do.
Absolutely.
So.
Maybe with that in mind, because these ladies have another show to do, believe it or not, I think I'm going to let you guys go and say, I want everyone to say thank you, because of course they've got a two-show day and they've been working really hard. Thank you. We can continue for a little bit, and then I want to answer your questions or just start a conversation with you, because I'm sure there's lots that you've been chewing on. But I think I'm curious to talk about Carol Churchill's sort of singular theatricality. For me, it feels like with every new play, she rediscovers what the theatrical world is. You know, she's recreating how a play is written each time she has something new to say. So, I mean, I guess I'd love, you know, as somebody who studies Churchill, to talk a little bit just about the sort of theatrical world in which she occupies.
So in 1977, she wrote a play called Traps. And this is a play you've never heard of because it's never done. It's a kind of theatrical, philosophical joke. You have a bunch of characters on stage. They seem to be in a kind of hippie commune. That's pretty clear. Things are said. Relationships are therefore established by the way things are said. And then somebody else comes in, and the conversation shifts entirely with no logical explanation for the shift. A baby is referred to as dying. Somebody else comes in and talks about the baby being alive. The baby's gender changes from one scene to the next. In other words, it looks like it should be normal. They're not speaking Greek. They're not turning and, you know, spouting Latin as Pope Joan does. And yet, you cannot ground yourself in any continuity.
Mm-hmm.
And she said in her notes to this play, I see this play as a Mobius strip.
Huh.
It's, you know, on a Mobius strip, the piece of paper, if you want to make it with a piece of paper. In fact, one of the characters makes a Mobius strip. It looks like there's two surfaces at least, but the trick is that on the Mobius strip, which is a, you know, mathematical problem, on the Mobius strip, there is really only one plane. It looks like two planes.
Right.
And she said very clearly that, for me, the theater is a place that is always potentially an impossible object. The impossible can and should happen on the stage. So we see by this last act, totally coherent, good British naturalism, right? Good naturalism. Two sisters together, they hate each other, they don't hate each other, they have a past that's complicated, they have a child that's, you know, this is a good meaty situation, right? And I disagree with Ben Brantley totally. I think this is beautifully written. I think it's a kind of anchoring moment in the play. I'd love to hear from you what you think. But she didn't want to write the play like that, you know? She didn't want to write the play like that. Formally, she wanted to make the play much more complicated. Let me tell you what she said about this play. I wanted to make a feminist play with no feminist in it. In other words, there is not one redeeming character, but all sorts of issues that matter, certainly that mattered in the early 80s to British feminists, are all there.
Right.
The nature of the top girl, you know, the good, what they called bourgeois feminism, right? Women rising to the top, crashing through the glass ceiling, but not caring at all about the social system or the inequalities built into capitalism. Churchill allied with the socialist feminists. She wanted a critique of that very system. She wanted people to get angry about the way things were. Now, does that mean she loves Joyce? No. It's much better art than that. But Joyce does stand for something in this play, right? It's the us and them, perhaps, of an old socialism. And we get all of that in the naturalism of the third act. But the first act, the incredible experimentation, the absurdity of these women coming out in these historical costumes, no explanation, that is part of the Churchill aesthetic, to let a certain historical density get into the stage. Naturalism, after all, is always rooted in a certain time and place. That's what makes it strong. Mm. She wanted to open up that time and place. She wanted to bring women in from past times and different times, and create precisely that historical resonance that she couldn't do with naturalism. So this play is almost a sort of, you know, primer for Churchillian talent, right? She can do the naturalism if she wants, but she's insisting on the impossible object as well. And then, of course, the middle scene, which I actually like the least, the office scene. Obviously, it's important to see that. I mean, it's very important to see that, right? Because all the things that those historical women were able to do despite their suffering, despite the loss of children, despite the unhappiness. The irony is, of course, in 1982, women are slotted into a tedious, bureaucratic, technological society, not able, in fact, to achieve, at least in fantasy, or even in fantasy, the kind of freedom that we saw, however the suffering was intense, the freedom that we saw at the beginning. So just as the actresses said, you know, how do these three things fit together? They fit together because Churchill has to give us and wants to give us Britain in the early 80s, a resistance to a kind of, you know, ruthless capitalism that Thatcher was launching into. She wants to give us that naturalism, but she wants to give us this complex historical resonance and suggest a kind of continuity between and a very long durée of course, women living in patriarchal societies and in conditions of oppression. So she wanted to have those echoes from the past in the present, and she gives us this amazing form to do it.
Well, that seems like a terrific place to begin our conversation about the play. We'd love to hear from you, love to hear your questions. I would just ask that if you ask a question, if you would stand up and speak clearly, and then I will repeat the question so everyone can hear it. So what are folks thinking about the play? Where can we begin? Is there anyone who has some thoughts or some questions? Yes, right there. Well, the question was, did Carol Churchill have anything to do with the physical environment, the set design, etc.? And certainly, Carol has worked with the director a lot, and the director works with his designer a lot. So there was a certain amount of collaboration. You know, certainly she looked at the design before it was before it was approved, before it was built, et cetera. I think the notion behind the design as a whole was the sort of everything that the actors were physically touching was real, and everything that the actors didn't touch was this, I mean, I think you noticed the sort of fabric house and the fabric office. Everything was very sort of realistic but made out of fabric, so that these people were sort of living in this ephemeral kind of world. And, you know, to speak to the notion behind the reflective floor, I don't remember those conversations, actually. I remember very, very clearly the idea of the sort of realism within the sort of unreal. So I think the floor is a part of that in a way that the sort of diaphanous, you know, settings, the house, the office, etc., in the same way that the play is real within the unreal. So I think it's about reflecting the larger conceit of the play, if that answers your question. Okay. Yes, right here.
Yes.
Exactly.
No. It's, you know, the discipline of these actors to achieve this script is just astonishing. It is like music. Thank you for saying that. I've always felt like that. I mean, it is like these women are struggling to be heard, so maybe they talk over each other, although, as we know, this happens in real life all the time. But she's interested in sound. Yeah. She wanted a soundscape as well as conversation, or she wanted to denaturalize those conversations because, you know, this is a very bizarre setup, and she doesn't want us to forget that. She doesn't want it to sort of be, you know, Williamsburg, mm-hmm. Virginia, you know, like where everybody's pretending to be a historical character. She wants the audience a little bit on edge like that. Mm-hmm. So this is what the text looks like. So you'd see a speech written for Nijo, right? And then there's a slash. And then let's say Gret is responding, or more likely Marlene is responding. At that moment of the slash, Marlene starts talking. That's the Churchill direction. Marlene starts talking. And then Nijo continues, because you saw that, right? But now Marlene is talking, again a slash. Yeah. Sometimes there's an asterisk. And when there's an asterisk, not just the sequential line, but the person even another space down, you know, the third person is supposed to start at the moment of the asterisk. So you not just have the slash, you have the asterisk. Mm-hmm. It is scored.
Yeah. And you know, these women are incredible because it is exactly precisely as written. Every time somebody is it is at exactly precisely the moment that Churchill wrote it. So you're hearing what was intended. So, yes, over here. Let me just restate the question, and you'll tell me if I've done it correctly. Just the way that men, the dynamic between men and women in the first scene, you know, the men who appear are sort of doing horrible things to women, and as we track through the play, the dynamic between men and women in the play.
No, that Marlene.
Only in relation to Marlene. In relation to children and childbearing?
Right.
I see.
Right.
Well, as does Marlene.
But Marlene abandons her too.
Yeah.
Right. Now this is a wonderful question. Right. Mm-hmm. Definitely. Right. Now this is a really important theme for Churchill. You know, she went to Oxford in 1958, and got married, and had three little boys within 5 years, 6 years. She was an only child. And when she came back to Britain, you know, so let's do biography, let's not be embarrassed, you know. She started writing radio plays because she had these little boys at home. And when they were a little bit older, you know, feminism really got moving. So she identifies with many different positions here, right? With the burden, with the pleasure, with the love, with the frustration, and so forth. Children are huge in her plays. There are babies, children, pregnant women, really pregnant women, you know, who then give birth later in the play, or not on stage, but in other words, the experience of childhood, I think she finds extremely important. It's important emotionally, it's important politically. She does feel a strong ethical responsibility that we all have to children, which is routinely ignored. It's ignored by governments, it's ignored by families, it's ignored by men and women. Pardon? It's ignored by feminists.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But the whole sort of critique of gender, which Churchill completely bought into, was that women were not essentially good and men were not essentially bad. I mean, that's another sort of strain of feminism that she never bought into. Mm-hmm. So frequently her female characters are rotten, grasping, utterly embracing of all the sort of much more capitalist than they are masculine values. I mean, she doesn't want that equation. You know, women are the suffering ones and the men are the brutes. Play after play disputes that. Not this play, but then this play, by not having men, allows for these women to take on these positions either of willing compliance, like Nijo. Of course, he owned me, this is how it was, and she suffers, but, you know, there's no question of resisting the system that put her there.
Well, she did hit the emperor with a stick.
Well, she finally gets some sort of revenge, that's true, and there's a lot of pleasure in that. But Churchill had no interest whatsoever in believing that women, by definition, were better nurturers. Yeah. What she used, I mean, I think the reason why she loves children in her plays is because children have no power. Children have no power, and their suffering and their confusion and their ability to sort of speak of their terrors if they can is something that really matters to her. Yeah. I mean, it's Angie who closes the play, frightening. Yeah. And this word occurs in play after play after play. Mm. I mean, just kind of say something quickly. The Pope Joan language is actually from Lucretius, who is an Epicurean philosopher from De Rerum Natura. And this long poem is all about espousing the notion that reality is what we see and what we touch, right? There is no God, there is no afterlife. It's a tough materialist Epicurean point of view. Hmm. And it's very amusing that the woman playing Joan, or the Pope Joan, you know, would quote from this philosopher. But the lines that she says, that she's quoting from, right before she throws up, is a reference to children. Children may fear death. Children may fear and have terrors. And then the line goes on, but the philosopher contemplates the rationality of nature and doesn't care about that. But Joan doesn't get to those last lines. She says, terror, invoking the child's terror, and then she can't go on. Hmm. Then it's as though that is the true reality. That is the true reality that she has to confront. And so, I mean, I hope I'm answering this. This business of families and the misery of children, the suffering of children, the bigness of children, the problem of women being mothers and also being in the world, this is central to her thing. But I guess what I just want to say quickly too is that it never then redounds to a play about a family. For her, these are emblematic relationships because they are important historically and important socially.
I think we have time for one more.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. Yes, in the blue shirt.
I was going to ask, as an audience of American culture,
The question is, how does the difference between the way that an American audience sees this play versus how a British audience might see this play, perhaps references that we don't understand, et cetera. I mean, I think certainly for our part at the theater, we presume that the play stands on its own and is beyond the sort of, I think that there's a life of the play that lives beyond the literal references. And I think if you don't know anything about Thatcherism at the time, there's much to be gained from the play, both in terms formally as well as in terms of just the emotional life of the play. But I'm curious what you would think about that, Ellen.
Oh, I think it's a great question. It's a really important question. And, you know, maybe Churchill was thinking of that when she gave Marlene the line, "I love Reagan."
Right.
I mean, that's us. We're in there.
There's a lot of discussion about America, actually, in the play.
Right. The children want to be, you know, Angie wants to be an American. That line is one of those lines that gets spoken over, but you hear her say that, "Will you take me to America? Things are fast in America." I frankly think Churchill is a little bit monotonal about America. I think she, there is a long-standing mistrust of the British-American relationship, and you know, basically we're sort of uncorked capitalism, and they're guilty capitalism. But you know, we're all in the same boat. So that's a great question. Accents, yeah. All these local things are different.
Sure, just one more and that'll be it.
Absolutely. Sure.
The question is about the title, and does Ellen, you know, feel that the title is ironic?
I think the title is great. I mean, I hate the girls business. You know, this was what this is feminism 1A. You don't call women girls.
But I think that's ironic, too.
But that's ironic, too. And by the way, I'm noticing that girls is back, you know.
Yeah.
It really is, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm your girl.
Good for you.
And, you know, on that note, I think we need to finish up. But thank you to all of you. Thank you to Ellen. Thank you to everyone.